This is a download from the Scottish Railway Preservation Society.
Just putting some lights on the engine now. We've got two lights showing it's a passenger train.
This is Soundbox, a magazine for railway enthusiasts around the world, coming to you from Bowness in Scotland.
Hello, and welcome to this, the 18th edition of Soundblast, the Scottish Railway Preservation Society's download, the totally non-visual magazine. I'm Sandy Simpson, and I'm right here in our studio with the indefatigable David Bytheway, the editor, producer, and roving reporter for Soundblast. In this edition, we'll bring you up to date with railway news at Bowness, we'll turn the spotlight on miniature steam locomotives, and we'll relive the steam age through some magical recordings. Most people will come to Bowness in West Lothian, the home of the Scottish Railway Preservation Society, to see the standard gauge locos. But the miniature locomotives are also crowd pullers, as David Bytheway found out when he talked to Russell Ainslie, chairman of the Edinburgh Society of Model Engineers.
Russell, lots of people come to Bowness to see the big trains, but
yes,
you've got a scale model one.
Yes.
What actually is it we're looking at? Can you describe it first?
Well, it's a steam locomotive. This was built during the war, and it's called Wild Memorial because the man was John Wild, and he was killed during the war, and his wife donated the engine to us, and we finished it and put it on the track 1954-56, and it's been running ever since.
It's a true model of a steam engine.
It's
got coal
model of it, yes. Coal, water, everything's exactly the same as a full-size steam engine.
And what is the gauge?
This one's a 5-inch gauge, but the coaches are 7 1/4 for security of the passengers.
So the gauge between the lines is 5 inches?
5 inches, that's correct.
What's the pressure it works at?
It works at just about 60, 65.
Where's a modern steam engine? What do they work at? What would
the bigger ones work at? 120, 140.
So the water, how much water does it take?
A lot. That's the safety valve blowing off.
Ready to go, is it?
Ready to go, yes.
Okay, can we hand over? We'll talk to you in a wee while later, but the train's ready to go.
Yes. Derek, you take the train away?
Yes, we're all ready to go now. The passengers are on board, and we'll go up the track and back again. Put it into reverse, and then we use the regulator to open the throttle a little bit.
Feet on the running board.
And here she comes. How does she look to you?
She's looking very good. She's worked hard all day.
Yes, nice and smooth there.
Very smooth.
What is it about models like this that attracts you rather than the big trains?
Well, I personally prefer to build rather than run. But the members in the club, there's a good mixture. So there's 70 of us. And some of them build clocks, some build stationary engines. One chap's built a Tiger tank. One chap's built a full-size Bugatti, and so on.
And what's your favourite? What's your?
I have an engine called Linda, which is from Ffestiniog Railway in Wales. So it's a copy of Linda and Blanche in Ffestiniog in Wales.
And where do you run it?
At Newliston, at the back of Newliston House. It's where the club society has its own railway. Half mile.
And do you have to be an engineer to join your club?
No, most certainly not. We've got accountants, civil engineers, policemen. Our latest member is a marine biologist.
It's quite a fair mix.
It's a good mix.
So is the secret, is what they're looking for, the magic of making things work.
Yes, I think it's the magic of things that move. They've perhaps got an idea from the past that they liked. So if they came from Yorkshire, they'll build a steam engine that was at their back door, or a train that they went to school on, or things like that from the past. Maybe their fathers were building something and they take it on. Some of the engines take quite a long time to build. They don't get built in an evening.
How long do you think?
Well, some people have been building them for 40 years. Depends how much you put into it.
40 years, eh?
And it's a long time. But we have this business of where you're interested when you're a child, but you've got exams and study. You go to university, you don't have much time. Then you get married, then you have children. And really we get the club is older members predominantly, but they've come back from being model engineers when they were younger. So that's how it seems to go, because you don't get time when you've got children and bringing up children.
Thanks very much indeed.
You're welcome.
George Lumsden is a hard-working member of the society who helps to make the wheels go round here at Bo'ness. He's always had an interest in trains because his dad worked on the railways in the period just after the war. George's mum is a good storyteller, and he had the foresight to recall the old lady's memories of life on the line. Here's George.
In 2001, I started to record some discussions with my mother, Isabel Lumsden, covering certain aspects of her memories of life at railway stations. It started in early 1946. My dad, Richard Lumsden, had been demobbed from the services and was returning to some position within the newly formed British Railways. Here's my mum talking about his first station, Ladiesbridge, on the Banff to Tillynott Junction line.
So he went up one Saturday night and got dinks in one of the hospital farm cottages over the weekend. Quite enjoyed himself. Phoned home to say how he was doing. The food is great. There is no scarcity of anything. So everybody looked hopeful. Can you get us some eggs when you get up there? Oh yes, we were to get you eggs, yes.
After years of wartime food rationing, having plenty of food was a blessing. My mum and dad settled into their new home, but there was just one drawback.
The only snag, we did not have a bathroom, not even a toilet. We had one of those old, ancient, dry privies in a corner of the unattended part of the garden. And we went up to have a look at it, and we were told, oh, the last maister in there had hens. And they just put the hens in there, and they laid their eggs there. And we looked inside, and there were two indentions in the straw on top of a board. And hens had obviously been using them. So I had to go back to the old farm, two buckets in there.
The two newcomers were made very welcome in their new community, especially by the ladies of the Women's Rural Institute.
So this was something I had been looking forward to, the Women's Rural Institute had been getting great publicity during the war. They helped, oh, in many ways. You always found rural members in the country laying on something for servicemen. If there was a camp nearby, they would get up push drives or a wee dance and a cup of tea and a bun or something like that. And it broke the monotony for a lot of the soldiers. At Ladiesbridge, there was a division of Polish army up at the old airfield. I went up to the rural. I thought of getting there in my bicycle, and my husband said, oh no, Mrs. Ritchie collects various members coming over from White Hills in her taxi, and she'll stop and pick you up, take you up there and bring you back home again. So you know you don't have to walk a few miles.
The station served the local agricultural and fishing community, and my mum remembers the fisherwomen with their creels joining the train.
I did notice one day a stout lady, elderly I would say, going with this huge basket in her back. She's going to some of the inland places with fish. She'll have smoked fish and probably fresh fish as well.
But not every journey involving fish was quite so happy.
There was an incident happened when we were not long at Ladies Bridge. It gave us quite a bit of amusement and certainly something to talk about. My husband came in one morning, mid-morning, after the train had been in, and said, "Close all the windows quickly. There's been a fish van, put off the train. It just came in. And it's certainly not for here. And there is a slight odour from it." Later on, my husband came up to say, "Believe it or not, that is a wagon of fish sent from Milford Haven to Newcastle and has somehow been sent up to Ladies Bridge in the north of Scotland, where we certainly don't need fish sent to us." So he and the porter on duty went over, opened it up, and whew, yes, it was full of good fish. Had been good when it was sent off. So he promptly contacted the head office in Aberdeen and got the train that was coming out of Bath to stop and pick it up and take it back to Aberdeen. But we still wonder about that. How come it was sent up here? Obviously somebody couldn't read the labels.
Nowadays, that would be put down to a computer error. In the next edition, my mum will be telling of their move to Riccarton Junction, where there were no roads and the railway was the only link with the outside world.
Fascinating stuff, which captures the spirit of a time so long gone by. And I think there'll be more in the next edition of Sound Blast. From Mrs. Lumsden's memories to the sound of steam from around the same time. It's time for Mike Yorlick to once again open his archive of historic steam recordings.
Hello and welcome to my steam archives. It's 9:04 PM on 22nd November 1966 at Cooper Station. Class B1460, number 61029, Shamwell, passes northbound with the 7:30 PM goods from Thornton to Dundee. The following evening at 6:28 PM on 23rd November 1966, Class B1460, number 61278, passes through Cooper Station. It's travelling light engine pushing a single brake fan from Dundee to Thornton. It's 6:13 PM at Cooper Station on 24th November 1966. Class V2262 number 60836 arrives with the early evening passenger train from Broughty Ferry to Edinburgh. 2 minutes later, the V2 departs with its syncopated three-cylinder exhaust beats echoing under the road overbridge and into the distance. That's it for just now. See you next time.
And if you have any recordings which you think we'd be interested in, get in touch with us. The details are at the end of the programme. Now, the curvature of the line in the final climb to Manual has been a concern since the line was reopened. David caught up with Donald McLeish, the head of S&T, and Ian Anderson, who has worked on the design of the revised layout, to learn more about the problem and the solution. Here's David with Donald.
Well, up at the west end of Manual, where the head shunt is, that track had been in since about, 1990. And it was laid with track that was available at the time, and that happened to be a couple of B7 turnouts, which are fairly tight, but not what you would say too tight for any specification. But perhaps in an ideal world you'd have a shallower turnout. So it'd been like that ever since, and when we made the line fit for passenger traffic up there, we had to then comply with a gradient of 1 in 500 for where the passenger trains would terminate. Previously the spec had been 1 in 260, so we had to do a little bit of work to ease the gradient there at the top end, and at the same time try and shallow the curve into this tight point.
What effect is that having on the trains?
Well, that particular turnout doesn't affect the carriages at all, because they stop and are uncoupled before that point, so it was really only locomotives and running round the train at the top end that it affected.
And this is what's caused the squeaking and that sort of noise going.
Yeah, inevitably, the tighter a curve is, the more flange wear and the more squealing you're going to get as it goes round a curve. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Ian, if you were responsible for surveying the site and trying to come up with a new answer, how did you succeed?
Well, we were actually very lucky, because a survey company who's just trying to set up into the railway surveying side asked us if we could use or test their new equipment on the site, and we got them to do Manual in return for getting all the results. So they brought their £50,000 worth of stuff on and gave us the line and levels of the existing rail. Part of the exercise, as well as replacing the turnout at the west end, was a thought for the future, that we could have a platform on the south side of the line rather than the north side where the embankment is. So we also decided, when we were doing this work, that we would regrade the south line to the 1 in 500, the magic 1 in 500 that Donald had mentioned. So it was a case of using the existing surveys and from data that we've got for these types of points, drawing out on a CAD-CAM system to see how they would fit in and how the alignment would be. I think people who know the West End would have noticed that with the existing point, there was a bit of a tight curve and a slight kink, in fact. And early on, when Manual was opened, we realigned it. So we introduced a double curve there, which looked bad, although it from an engineering point of view, it was okay, but we've managed to eliminate that with the shallower point. So it was a case of deciding what depth we'd put the new line at, or the south line at, how we'd have to dig out the where the existing point is to get the new point in, and leave it in a way that at some time in the future we may also think about changing the point at the east end, because it's still quite tight.
Was there some difficulty with the point components that you had?
Yes, we were using components which we already had lying about in the yard. The one thing was that the point at the west end is what we would call a left-hand point, but in fact the components we had was a right-hand point. So of course with Donald's enthusiasm and optimism, we soon turned the left hand into the right hand, right into the left, but that just added to the excitement and the general work that we had to do with the job.
So we're recording this early in June 2012. What state are we at the moment?
For the overall project, well, if you're considering the track work, perhaps we've gone two-thirds of the way through. But really, at the end of the day, we really ought to have a platform there for passengers to be able to get off at, and possibly even generate a car park and some pathways and maybe a picnic area and put a water tower up there for all sorts of things. So in terms of overall project, less than halfway.
Thanks very much indeed.
And that pretty well wraps things up, except to report that David has been to the pictures to see the Angel Share. You may remember we reported on how Ken Loach used Burke Hill for one of the scenes. That sequence opens the film, and the society gets its name up in lights in the credits. David says it's a very funny and moving film. But don't take your grandmother. Some of the language is very coarse. You can contact us online at www.srps.org.uk/soundblast, all lowercase. That's www.srps.org.uk/soundblast. Or you can write to us at soundblast, 2 months this time with initial capitals, soundblast, SRPS, Union Street, Bowness, West Lothian, EH519AQ, Scotland. The tireless roving reporter, editor and producer has been David Bytheway. And I'm Sandy Simpson, wishing you all that you wish yourself from everyone here at the Scottish Railway Preservation Society at Bowness in Bonnie Scotland.